Welcome to the Planning Podcast. I'm Richard Kimblin. Today we turn to the Labour Party's idea of using the compulsory purchase regime and modifying the approach to hope value to reduce the uplift at which a landowner might attract on receipt of planning permission for residential development. There is such a long list of issues that today we're going to turn to a detailed episode of the Planning Podcast, joined by three experts: Richard Blythe, Head of Policy and Practice at the RTPI, Paul Brocklehurst, Chairman of the Land Promoters and Developers Federation, and Christian Hawley, Barrister at Number 5 Chambers and frequent guest on this podcast. Let's see what the issues are and what they have to say.
Hello and good afternoon, Richard.
Afternoon.
So, I thought it'd be great if we could get together and just canvass some of the points which arise immediately from what Keir Starmer is contemplating in terms of land values and the option for local authorities to compulsory purchase land for residential development, but most importantly, without any legal obligation to pick up what is referred to as hope value, that is the uplift in value derived from the anticipation of the grant of a residential consent and the associated difference in land value. So at the end of May, that's what was trailed primarily via an article in The Guardian and on the same day in the FT, confirmed by the party to be the party's position. And it struck me that's something that, from both a landowner's, land promoter's and planning perspective, would be something that people would like some orientation on. So I thought the first thing that we might just have a chat about is whether or not there is indeed any sort of problem. Do you, within the RTPI, detect that there is any sort of problem in terms of the value which is ascribed to land when it comes forward to residential development? I imagine the answer to that's fairly straightforward, but What's your take, Richard?
Well, I think ever since the Shinfield decision, which about 10 years ago, which I'm sure you know more about than me, Richard, happened, was that on that occasion, the planning inspectorate decided that it would be reasonable to give 50% of the uplift in agricultural land value to infrastructure provision and affordable housing and 50% to the landowner. In an appeal decision. And I haven't really followed all of this, you know, case by case since, but it does occur to me that it was slightly strange that the planning inspectorate was setting policy like this. And, you know, there could be people who would say, well, maybe landowners should get 25% or 15%. And there could be landowners that think that maybe 75% was due return for them bringing their land forward. So this comes at a time when it seems to be a very unclarified part of public policy, and yet one that obviously is very important to the kind of people who have encouraged politicians to look for solutions to it. I think the other question that comes in this space is not so much about the hope value question as about the question of land coming forward. And I don't mean build out, which was the kind of thing that has often been discussed in this context. Former Labour leader talking about use it or lose it. I mean the fact that if a town is to develop sustainably and outwards, as it may well need to do, if the incidence of that development is left entirely to owners' preferences, which happens if it's an unplanned process, you can get a situation where what might in technical terms be the most suitable next field being withheld from the market because of the owner's preference. And that, I think, is an aspect of how the state involves itself in the land market, which is perhaps not so often considered. So this is not hope value. This is more like spatial direction.
Let's pick up the next field point and just have a look at one of the ideas which seems to be behind the proposal. And it's looking back to those occasions when new communities were established in new locations on the basis of compulsory purchase of land and the setting up of development corporations, etc. And perhaps looking beyond the incremental growth of settlements to the establishment of new settlements, and one sees many examples presently of garden town proposals at different stages of development, from mere ideas to actually having support within local plans. And there is that concept as well, the concept of using it on a big scale to create very substantial amounts of housing.
That, I think, is where we perhaps are beginning to verge on the questions of whether CPO itself is the right tool in this space. So we are not in the world of 1949 any longer. We don't have government restrictions on the number of bricks that may be used in the private sector and the amount of concrete and so forth. So the world in which the compensation and betterment principles behind the original Planning Act existed has long gone. And I mention this because, yes, in those days you could say, well, we are going to build Stevenage or Harlow, and we've set up a development corporation, and we need, you know, so many hundreds of acres of land to do our job, and we have drawn a red line on a map, a designated area, and so kind of anybody whose farm lies within this area could be said on one reading to be kind of getting in the way of a state project, and therefore the state has some standing in saying you are going to be given back the value of your farm that you've lost as a farm, and you know your area is going to be incorporated in a new town. Now, quite apart from whether we could do that these days, I think one of the sort of necessary conditions is that you have that proposal. And I think this is something to do with the concept of the scheme and no scheme world, which I'm sure you know more about than me. But I think the difficulty is that I'm not clear whether the Labour Party or any future government is seriously planning to build a new town of, say, 50,000 population and has got development corporation in place and has written a development plan in the sort of manner that we did in the 50s and 60s. So without that background, it seems very difficult to argue at all whether you could use compulsory purchase, because you haven't got a thing which the landowner is arguably holding out against.
Well, that's sort of two ends of the spectrum that we've covered off, isn't it? That the incremental growth of a settlement with low hundreds of dwellings to new towns, 50,000. Let's just see if we can contemplate a little what the announcement, if it is an announcement, is really aimed at. It seems from the reporting to be very much focused upon reducing the extent of the increase in value, reducing the multiple. And so very high multiples are cited in the press as to the increase from agricultural land value to residential land value. And that is the innuendo there is that that is a bad thing because it reduces the opportunity to divert some of that cost to communities and facilities which communities need. That's seems to be the essence of the social argument. There may be mechanisms to achieve the same outcome, perhaps more efficiently, because some of the contrary argument focuses upon the procedural and the legal difficulty of bringing about a CPO in the first place. So one thinks instantly as to whether or not, because this is in fact what it is, a land tax is more apt.
Well, I'm just thinking when you started on this discussion around is there a problem, it now makes me think that there have been a lot of proposals to build new communities in the countryside, thinking of places like North Essex. To my recollection, the issue of hope value was not central to the discussion. And going back to that Shinfield decision, I mean, it is case by case, but there are quite a lot of cases where new communities proposals have been put forward where quite a lot less than 50% of the uplift is going to the owners. So it's the same that we don't have a regular set of rules, but it seemed to me, recalling the Essex cases, that it wasn't so much the problem of hope value as a lot of other questions that led to proposals not coming forward. Whether in the case of large proposals, hope value is the question, I think would need a little further unpicking. And as you say, there is, I think, a role for compulsory purchase in relation to ransom strips. So say you have a large proposal in a local plan for or maybe even a town of 5 to 10,000 units. And a lot of landowners would like that to happen, and one landowner doesn't. There is a question as to how much one person can thwart a proposal of that kind in terms of land assembly. And that's, I think, very much a question of degree. So, you know, if a person owns a plot that is equivalent to the size of one house, you might argue that the state has some argument to say, well, if you'd only sell your one house at the value of what a house is worth, which is not a hope value question at all, we can now get access to 5,000 houses in the area behind your house, and all the other landowners would like that to happen. But then, you know, how far do you go? Would you argue that compulsory purchase could be used if there were, say, four major landowners of whom three were happy and one wasn't? That enters into another series of quite difficult discussions as to whether the state should then be involved in coercing the fourth one to join the club of three. So that's a case where the use of CPO to bring about sort of social change can't necessarily be described in terms of black and white. There's a continuum of perhaps easily agreed to principles in the case of, you know, a very small ransom strip, to perhaps more contentious areas where you're talking about land assembly, where quite large chunks of it are potentially subject to compulsion. But it's interesting because we do that in town centres. So most compulsory purchase is taking place in built-up areas, not in the countryside. And there's quite an established principle that if you're wanting a town centre regeneration scheme to go ahead, that the local state is somehow considered empowered to complete a land assembly process where there are a number of people holding out against the scheme. And that can lead to some very aggrieved landowners and, you know, cases that flow out of public inquiries where people feel inadequately compensated by the system. But it's interesting that there's been no serious querying of the idea that land assembly within built-up areas can take place. And actually, in some sense, the human rights issues are less serious in the countryside because you're not necessarily taking away people's homes, but you may be taking away parts of their businesses.
Yes, and what you do there by looking at the land assembly question is that you identify and illustrate that the fact of the powers being in place, because we all know from practice of examples where such land assembly has taken place or where it has been mooted and perhaps frustratingly a local authority has declined to become involved. And really what the focus is in terms of Labour's proposals is really very little to do with compulsory purchase. It's all to do with compensation. It's all focused on the compensation aspect, which is why your ransom strip point is such a good example, because that is the prime example, Stokes and Cambridge, of the value which somebody is attaching to their land being the impediment and or being the destination of a substantial amount of total project value, which might otherwise find itself manifested in terms of affordable housing or off-site mitigation of one sort or another.
I'm glad you mentioned mitigation, because I think one of the other things that sometimes perhaps the press misunderstand in this debate is that it's sometimes seen as a kind of a dishing out of goodies. You know, should the community get these goodies or should the landowner get these goodies? As if somehow it was a negotiation between two parties. But actually, planning law has established that Section 106, which is the way we currently approach land value issues, has a series of rules around fairness and reasonableness, which mean that actually, when it comes to the development of greenfield land, the purpose of extracting value for the community is in order to provide some community benefits. It might be a community centre, but a lot of it goes on some rather mundane and not very exciting issues, such as building sewers. This idea that it's somehow a tussle between giving money to the worthy and well-deserving public against the nasty landowner is an odd way of putting it. Because we do normally direct quite a lot of value to the construction of infrastructure. Far more goes on those unromantic things than goes on perhaps things that people notice more of, like the community centre or the new village green. So I think that is one reason why it would help if the debate was framed rather differently in terms of the infrastructure that needs to be put in place. And also, another reason is that there are other ways of going about this that other countries have used, and in fact, we have in this country used in the past, which is that the planning authority provides the infrastructure, and then the private sector comes in and undertakes the development. One of my first jobs, or my actual first job in planning, was to work for a local authority which had providentially, and 15 years before, bought a large estate on the outskirts of the town and then allocated that estate as the direction of the town expansion. So you don't get that so much these days, but in our engineering and technical services department, we had a lot of people whose job was to build roads and sewers, and then we sold the plots off that had been improved by this investment and recouped the money for the local authority by selling off the plots that had been improved, including some very innovative solutions for that era around custom build and social housing. So you don't have to sort of start from a position where, I don't know, you're kind of waging war against a landowner. There are other ways of doing it, and also quite interesting possibilities around joint ventures. And the perhaps now forgotten Letwin review, which was actually addressed at a different question, it was addressed at slow building, but he had some very good examples of from around Europe where actually the local authority could adopt a much more proactive role in forward providing infrastructure, which would kind of remove quite a lot of this discussion.
So I think that local authorities must then need a DSP, a Department of Serviced Plots, to start moving this forward in a way which has the potential, in fact, to then provide the funding which in so many authorities is sadly lacking. It has that potential too.
The other thing is that it's not just about private land. So if you were to do a kind of hectare by hectare satellite eye in the sky, look at the land that this country needs to house its people in the future, awful lot of it belongs to the public sector or quasi-public sector, and organisations such as water companies, which own a phenomenal amount of land. So the public sector could set a very good example by how it develops its own land. Just looking at the history of somewhere like North Stow in Cambridge, a very sad story of public sector land ending up in a quite suboptimal and very delayed process, simply because the money that was originally paid to Ministry of Defence for the site was so excessively high that the options for the future have been very much constrained. Now, you know, where CPO comes in that kind of discussion, I don't know, but it's interesting that this isn't simply a story of somehow a group of private landowners and how they relate to the state. There is a whole lot of other land that should be brought into the discussion.
Well, Richard, I intend to pursue the discussion further with those who have an interest in promoting land and whose entire business model is dependent on that. And what I'm going to do is gather together some of those fantastic ideas that you've put forward and put them to them and see what the reactions are. And hopefully at the end of it, having heard from different quarters, there will be the option for people to be a bit better informed. But for now, I'm really grateful for all of those contributions. They're really fantastic. As ever, Richard, your knowledge and input is encyclopedic. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
So then we turn from Richard's valuable contribution to a discussion between Paul and Christian on some of those same issues, but from slightly different perspectives, and taking us a bit further, including to the question of how local plans would cope with this new proposal.
Hello, good afternoon to Paul and good afternoon to Christian. How are you both?
Very well indeed, thank you, Richard.
Very well, thank you, yes.
Now, Paul, you are joining us from a particular organisation. Tell us about the organisation that you joined from and what it's about.
Okay, I'm chairman of the Land Promoters and Developers Federation, Richard. Effectively, our members on a daily basis, in fact, almost on an hourly basis, are interacting with local planning authorities around the country, principally to attempt to get a residential development use on land that is currently either not allocated or is allocated for development in a local plan. And it is an interesting period in which to be doing that. I think that might be a very understated way in putting that. But they're doing that every day, throughout the day, and we try and represent them, engage with government and stakeholders around that planning system to see whether we can ensure that it works efficiently.
Well, I see some of your policy output and some of the materials which come from the organisation, and I can see how very helpful they will be to your members and others who see them and for that engagement. And I can quite appreciate just how bewildered people might be from time to time, given what's going on and the amount of it. And today, as we've identified, we're going to look at a relatively new idea at the end of May, the suggestion that there may be, if there was a Labour government or a Labour government in collaboration with others, perhaps, that there may be some land value capture. And the first point there's got to be whether or not there is a problem in that the value of land and the uplift associated with it is siphoning off in a disproportionate way that value, whereas in fact the proportionate response is for more of that to go into social infrastructure and the things that the planning system tries to provide. Is there a problem that needs to be addressed?
I'll step in first, Christian, but please feel free to cut across at any point in time. And all I would say, Richard, I suppose I'd say a couple of things. First of all, at this point in time, I'm always careful to respond in a measured way to potential or policy pronouncements from political parties 15 to 18 months ahead of a general election, and probably get more excited if it appears in a manifesto. But I think within your question are so many things that can be unpacked. For me, one of the starting points is an assumption that all land around the country is created equally and has a similar notional value between its agricultural value or its existing use value and its value should it get a residential consent. And I think for all of us, we would probably acknowledge that there are large parts of the country which have no real land value over and above the cost of build and indeed the build margin for the people that are taking the sales risk on doing that. And therefore their ability to make contributions to local infrastructure and affordable housing may well be very limited. Now, in other parts of the country, that clearly isn't the case. And there is a land value under normal market circumstances, and I add that caveat because we're potentially not in a normal market, or certainly we might not be entering a normal market. So we've got deflationary value pressures, and we've had a period of pretty high cost inflation, build cost inflation, and there are other issues such as biodiversity net gain and nutrients, which are adding to costs, which mean that that land value that is there is coming under pressure. But it is certainly the case in areas of constrained supply through Greenbelt policies, AOMB or something of that ilk, that there have been areas of the country where land values have been higher. And then there is the question posed, is the existing system catching enough of that uplifting value? But rather than hog the conversation, I'd rather pass over to Christian and then maybe come back on that latter point.
Christian, do you want to do some more unpacking of my rather dense question?
Yes, there is a lot in there. For me, the starting point is that really there are two principal threads to the consideration of the question. One is a political question. You know, if one is a free marketeer, then there's a big question mark over policies which are effectively tantamount to state intervention to deprive individuals of their property. The second thread is the application in the real world. Are there sites where there are significant uplifts in value as a result of the grant of planning permission? Yes, of course there are. Are there many sites where they're all factors taken into account, build costs, remediation, contributions to X, Y, and Z, many sites where, in fact, there is not some huge uplift in value, which is returned to the landowner? Yes, there are. Equally, that practical world consideration is mostly one of geography. There are locations, there are hotspots, they're not all in the south. And they're the places where that land value is high. Why are they high? Well, because of supply versus demand. And that's when we come back to the first point, the political question. Why does demand outstrip supply in many locations? Well, because the state rations the grant of planning permission. The purpose of the plan, when we're off to go and do an examination in public, the purpose of the plan is to meet the needs of the district, identified using various methods and tested. But ultimately, it's, you know, what is the minimum housing number? What is the necessary amount of employment land I require in order to achieve my economic objectives? What is the necessary infrastructure that I require to deliver the plan? When you look at it in those terms, it's not aspirational, is it? It's what do I need to do to effectively cover what I need to deliver? That's the issue, really. Because depending on your political point of view, somebody would say, well, it's the state that's granting the permission. Therefore, the state is entitled to a greater proportion of the uplift in value. That's one argument. The alternative is, well, it's the state that's appropriated the decision as to what is permitted to be built on this land. So why then should the state also benefit from effectively reducing supply and pushing up prices because of that appropriation? For me, I think the question and the second part of the question was in relation to proportionality and that which should be going into social infrastructure. You know, the idea at the minute is that a site should, viability aside, wash its own face in the sense that whatever pressures it places out there in the real world as a result of its development, then it is supposed to provide whatever through financial contributions, direct provision, whatever it might well be, sufficient and adequate infrastructure to support whatever it is, be a retail development, you know, a logistics scheme or residential housing. But that's the point. And if you want to go beyond that, as in, this site shouldn't simply contribute toward meeting the effects and impacts that arise as a result of its development, but should somehow contribute more, that it, in fact there should be positive net gain socially in the community, then that is fundamentally for me a political question. The practical point comes in that even if you do decide that that is how planning should work, and effectively more value should be captured and distributed publicly, does that actually work other than in the particular hotspots where land values end up being high when permission is granted?
Well, that's a beautiful turnaround to Paul's central point that not all land has been created equally, was the way that he put it. So thank you for bringing us back to that point. But what you've emphasized is that this is a political question. And it, of course, arises in the context of Labour starting to position themselves for a general election. Paul?
I'd just like to sort of pick up on a couple of points, because Christian's absolutely right. I mean, we've operated in a system over many decades now where effectively the supply of planning consents has been constrained significantly below the level of need that this country has. I mean, there have been no end of think tank reports over the last 6 months that have suggested that the figure of 300,000 is an underestimate of our annual requirement, partially because of the historic under-delivery, and that the figure should be much higher. And of course, over time, if you delivered the required amount of land into the market, over time, theoretically, supply and demand would equalize and land value may not have the same excesses in certain areas that it might be perceived to have at the moment. So that's one point. I think the other point is Christian expressed it very nicely, very neatly, in that there seems to be the view that the state delivers the consent. Now, for those of us who operate in the system on a daily basis, we know that there are insufficient resources within local planning authorities to actually be able to fully assess whether a site is deliverable at a local plan stage. So many landowners, land promoters, house builders are investing significant amounts of capital, financial capital, to put forward land and prove to local authorities that it is deliverable. And therefore, it isn't something that the state has created with no input or financial risk by the private sector. Now, perhaps there's an argument at that point, what is a reasonable return on your financial capital that you've invested? But that isn't the way that the conversation is currently framed. It is a very simplistic conversation. And I think this gets back to Christian's point that it starts from a political perspective, which then gets me on to the third point, which is Christian again highlighted, which is what I think is one of the issues in development at this point in time, which will never be faced or admitted to by the current politicians of whichever hue, is what we're fighting against is the underinvestment in public infrastructure, existing infrastructure, over the last number of decades. And that may actually have nothing to do with the number of houses that have been built in your local authority area, because there are a number of local authority areas where very few houses have actually been built over the last 10 or 20 years. But people perceive, sometimes rightly, that the infrastructure for the population has not kept pace, whether it be the NHS or so on and so forth. And I think one of the ways that politicians are seeing as a way of resolving that is effectively to tax new development. That is what we're talking about. But of course, I think one of the points would be there are existing methodologies of taxation. First of all, land value is captured via a local plan process and a Section 106, and in some areas, community infrastructure levy. And there's a debate as to whether that may be sufficient. But some of that comes from, have the public sector service providers engaged with local plan processes sufficiently to evidence the costs that new development places on that infrastructure? I think the answer from my personal experience is that very rarely has that occurred in the past sufficiently. And I think planning inspectors are very capable of considering those requests for funding at that local plan point in time. But then in addition to has there been sufficient interaction with our existing system, it's perfectly possible for a politician to change the capital gains tax regime, for instance, on land already. That is, you know, capital gains tax is there, we'll just change it, change rollover reliefs. But they find it much easier to talk in terms of land value capture and CPO, and that's probably what's led to the infrastructure levy discussion that we're all weighed under by the consultation documents that we've seen recently.
Tax. So really you're saying that the proposal from May is in essence a tax in its broadest sense. But you're canvassing, aren't you, Paul, an alternative mechanism, a different lever to pull, which might address such concern as might be appropriate.
Richard, I would argue it's not an alternative methodology. I would argue that's the methodology that we have at the moment, and nobody is, very few people are using it appropriately. If we did and maybe one of the larger planning consultancies have done this piece of work, but if we looked at the number of local plans in areas where those land values were high and actually understood how many were up to date, and therefore where the public sector could have engaged with that local plan process to put forward proposals for the contributions required from new development in support of the infrastructure and services in a particular area, I suspect they'd be the local plans that we don't have.
Okay.
So all I'm saying is there is an existing system, but nobody's using it. And therefore, everybody ends up coming up with new methodologies. You know, we have a capital gains tax regime. Well, make it fit for purpose. If you don't think it's capturing enough of the gain from land value. All I'm saying is, whether it's infrastructure levy or CPO to some extent, they are reactions to a lack of use of the existing system.
Got it. Okay. Well, let's hypothesize. Let's go to a scenario where there is such a procedure in place where CPO can be undertaken by a council as planning authority, and it is absolved from paying the hope value, the uplift associated with the consent. Let's take that position. What sort of issues do you think that might give rise to? And either Christian or Paul can go first, whoever wants to jump in. And by issues, what effect is it going to have, do you think, if we have that playing out in these areas where the values are higher?
I think there's two different parts to that question. The first is, how does that play out within the CPO system? And secondly, how does that play out, the threat of it, as it were, or the advent of it, the availability of it, how does that play out in terms of market effect and landowner behaviour? In terms of the first, how does that affect the CPO system? That's a more straightforward question to answer, because much of the process will remain exactly the same. In fact, when you're dealing with a CPO, and you know, if there are objectors and if you do end up at an inquiry, the actual question of valuation of compensation is a can that's kicked down the road anyway, and doesn't feature in the test of, has a case been demonstrated that there's an overriding interest, public interest in the grant of the order, the ability to compulsory purchase private land. Now, the proposals will have, depending on the particular scheme, some effect on the process, on the procedure, because if it is a CPO for development of X number of houses on brownfield land in a city, or if it is acquisition of many hectares of agricultural land to deliver an urban extension, not only does that have to be a good thing in the sense that it's in the public interest, but it must be demonstrably deliverable as well. And obviously what the acquiring authority would be doing is looking at a viability appraisal or producing a viability appraisal to demonstrate that not only should the land be, that the land should be acquired, it's in the public interest because we are going to be able to deliver it. Well, that viability appraisal presumably is predicated upon an under market value for the land. So it creates some odd distortions, doesn't it? Because then what happens in terms of any surplus? Unless that viability appraisal, meeting all the relevant contributions, shows, you know, it overall to be cost neutral, it will cost the authority how much it will get back once it's sold all the units. Well, if it's making a profit, which one would anticipate it should be in some scenarios, what's the process for dealing with that? And why is the local authority able to, or whatever the body is, why is that body able to generate a profit through the ability to acquire land for less money than any other market participant? And that then leads to the second point, the effects on the market. Well, how do you balance that playing field when, you know, we've got a market for land?
Don't you level necessarily?
Well, that's the idea. It depends, doesn't it? And again, that's a political question. What degree of intervention in the market should there be? And the ability of certain actors, state actors, to use compulsory purchase powers to go out into the market effectively and acquire a finite ingredient for development, i.e. land, at a lower price than any other market participant, distorts that market and can potentially have some perverse effects in terms of, you know, choices of individuals. You know, does it put off developers from operating in districts where the local authority is reasonably acquisitive using the powers? But, you know, by no stretch of the imagination, unless there's going to be some huge influx of both capital and resources, are local authorities going to be taking on the bulk of house building in those districts? So does tinkering around the edges, is it counterproductive? Does it just put off people because of the risk of competing against, you know, not competing on a level playing field? And then equally in terms of the market, it could have, you know, very serious implications for landowners, couldn't it? And presently, I suppose the point is, if I were to be CPO'd, I might not like it, but I am going to get the market value for my property, which will, if I can demonstrate that planning permission will be granted for an alternative higher use value, on the balance of probabilities it would be, then, you know, I'm okay. I'm not losing out. It's a real pain. If it's my house, it's a real pain because I need to go and move somewhere else. If it's a field that I own, it's still a bit of a pain, but I should be compensated. Well, how about actually I'm losing my house because it's where the council wants to put an access to a 40-bed scheme, but, you know, I've got a reasonably large garden and I was planning on putting 3 houses on there. Why should I as an individual not get the market value? Is it going to make me more likely to contest the CPO? Yes, it probably is. So there's all sorts of potential ramifications other than simply this is a great idea to boost house building and get a greater share of development profit for social benefit.
Mm.
I think some of it stems to an earlier point that Christian made, which is about the right of enjoyment or ownership of a private asset by an individual. And I suppose one of the things I struggle with is that what we look as if we're going to be doing is with greenfield land in particular, which is most frequently in the areas that we've already identified in our conversation, could deliver or lead people to believe that there is more value to be captured, is that effectively you're going to turn around and say to somebody, I am going to appropriate your asset that currently you are using for a productive use of farming, let's say. I think we have a problem in this country of not being clear, and I think it comes through in a number of other issues as well that we're experiencing as an industry, in being clear on what is valuable to society as a whole. Is it agriculture? Is it housing? Is it the environment? Is it energy security? And all of these things are competing uses for land, all lead to potentially differential land values. And what we're trying to say is we want to buy it at the cheapest possible value, which we determine is the agricultural value. I think you are going to find that many landowners will not do that willingly, because it feels as if somebody is seizing your asset. I think the other point is, I sit here and probably don't yet get too excited about the whole prospect because of something that Christian's already alluded to, which is, I think the skills and level of resource for local authorities to actually undertake this is very significant indeed. We're talking about this at a time when local planning authorities are already significantly under-resourced to cope with their existing core functions. So I find it difficult to think that on the scale that is hypothesized, that is going to be possible within a given period. And therefore, I sort of go back to my original point, which is what should be being talked about is, if there is land value, what is a fair and reasonable proportion to capture? And if you don't believe that it's currently fair and reasonable in a particular area, well, we have an existing process in which that can be debated and discussed and evidence can be put forward. The previous attempts for more direct methodologies of land value capture, you've effectively had, I'd call it a landowner strike. And that doesn't sound as if it's going to deliver more housing quickly.
Yes, it's quite normal, isn't it, to encounter significant landowners who have a very, very, very long view, and only when it really suits them will they bring their land forward. And you can foresee, can't you, a number of those very substantial landowners just taking their time.
Mm. I think the skills of the sector are often about navigating their way through a very complex planning system, needlessly complex on occasion, really, but a very complex planning system. But actually, it starts before that, which is many years of negotiation, and I probably don't under-exaggerate with the many years of negotiation with landowners to bring land forward, and on what basis they're willing to see their land brought forward. And there are all sorts of landowners all around the country. And, you know, I find it interesting when we're talking about this, how we view, for instance, the church commissioners, who have brought in sort of policies themselves where they wish to ensure appropriate levels of affordable housing delivery on the land that they bring forward, where many of them are sort of colleges of universities who hold it to fund investment in their establishments. Are we effectively saying that those would be appropriated as well?
Well, I do wonder, you know, maybe there's scope for this provision for going large. So what about new towns? Not just bolting on a few hundred dwellings here, a few hundred dwellings there, but substantial new settlements. Is that something that it could be used for?
In theory, I suppose one aspect of that is that if it is a new town, a new settlement out in the what is presently countryside somewhere, then the market value of that land is probably somewhere around agricultural value, because there isn't any hope attached to it until one comes in with a new town proposal. There isn't any hope attached to it that really you'll ever get planning permission for anything else. And that, you know, that valuation exercise means that in that circumstance, you can, you know, you can see the starting point of an argument, well, you need to discount hope value. But through the CPO process, you discount the scheme anyway. You value in a no scheme world. So you have to ignore the fact that there might be a new town. You have to treat it as countryside. So really, what difference does that, what difference does the proposed reform make of ignoring hope value?
Should be
so I give you the challenge then of explaining to Sir Keir Starmer the operation of the no scheme world presumptions. And let me know how you get on.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I don't know. I can sometimes be accused of being slightly cynical. And I don't know when we get these broad policy ideas, whether they're put out there because overall the idea sounds quite good and we'll worry about the detail later. It sounds good, doesn't it? It's gonna, we can say we're doing something about how the housing crisis, we're doing something about taking money out of wealthy landowners' pockets, unearned income, et cetera, et cetera. It's ticking a good number of boxes. I recognise there are issues because, you know, in reality, where we would deploy it for a new town, for example, the reform itself would have very little difference on the outcome. There will be perverse consequences. For example, that landowner taking a long-term view, instead of him or his appointed team turning up to the examination in public of the local plan, promoting his landholding on the edge of whatever settlement it is, because they want to be in the plan and allocated, you could almost see a situation where they're turning up, all tooled up, to object to the fact that they've been identified by the local authority for allocation, because they know that what follows the allocation is the CPO. And in reality, as a precursor to that, it goes back to the time and the resource point. Who in the local authority presently, without bringing in additional expertise and funding the required number of people to deal with it? We've all looked at a call for sites exercise. Quite often it's outsourced to consultants anyway, but even when it isn't, it's very simplistic. So imagine that flip round where the authority isn't simply going through a call for sites on the basis of what people who want to be in the plan are telling them, but actually identifying themselves sites which are suitable for development without having any knowledge of them. No ownership on them, very little information on them, and then facing those landowners turning up an examination to say, oh, well, you shouldn't allocate my land for all of these following reasons. It floods, can't solve the drainage problem. We've got this highways issue. You know, you haven't demonstrated that there's adequate provision for biodiversity net gain. You can see all sorts of those kind of weird and wonderful perverse issues coming out. Back to your question, Richard, are they recognised by those who come up with the headline policies? I think they probably are, but I think they're probably ignored because they don't fit the narrative.
So what you've identified there is really the precursor to any CPO process, that in order to be able to demonstrate the relevant test for obtaining a CPO, you're going to have development plan policy essentially in the form of an allocation. And so you've identified for us, Christian, the first step being a plan which is up to date and allocates the land that a local authority has a view to CPOing. And that brings with it the perhaps interesting representations that you just outlined for us, but also some of the authorities that we're talking about have found it difficult to get local plans in place in a timely way. And what you're suggesting is that that would need to flip, that those local authorities with the high value land areas in them would need to be on it and be very prompt and up to date in putting in place their local plans in order to give effect to this potential new policy.
Yeah.
Or have I misunderstood?
Exactly that. I can't help but feel it would be a fairly unattractive argument for an inspector at a CPO inquiry for a council to say, don't worry about the planning permission because we grant the planning permissions. So yes, I do consider that, you know, there needs to be some demonstrable ability to develop the site. And in order to get to that point, the only way that sites can be allocated is through a local plan. And we've, you know, I think you've been put it fairly generously there, Richard, to say that some of them have had some difficulties. Some authorities haven't adopted plans for 20 years, sometimes longer. They're the extreme, obviously, but there's plenty out there who have passed the 5-year review period and then all recognise that a review won't cut it and that they need effectively a new plan or a new plan under the name of a review, but simply rubber stamping what they've got won't do the job. And then that's another 3 years or 4 years, depending on elections, depending on the political views of members, depending on whether there is going to be another announcement of changes to the framework that might give pause to authorities to think, I think I'll just hang on and see how that plays for me. There are difficulties, obviously, as well, in the sense that those allocations would, presumably, the idea is that they would be for the plan period, the full plan period. But we know that quite often plans end up out of date and we have these allocations. How quickly are they actually going to come forward? You know, the CPO process isn't quick. And if an authority is putting it in as a plan to be delivering, you know, whatever, in year four, that would seem mighty optimistic, given that there is an incentive for anybody who is affected to object to the allocation and to the CPO because they are being deprived of the true market value of their asset.
I think, Christian, I agree completely with the point on new towns because, you know, and I don't have any objection to the use of new towns, but I make two points. First of all, on a sort of discounted cash flow basis, by the time you've taken in the length of time to develop a new town and the costs required to be input to develop the infrastructure at the appropriate times in a new town, you would get to a land value already under the existing CPO arrangements, which probably wouldn't be considerably ahead of agricultural values in real terms. So I'm not sure you need a new methodology to do it. The other thing with new towns, and I can't have a conversation about tangentially to planning without mentioning it. I think new towns require a level of strategic planning that currently I would suggest we don't have. And perhaps we should. In fact, I'd argue that we should have some level of strategic planning. But perhaps that's why some of the cross-boundary communities have struggled to get traction in the current environment.
A brilliant point. Yes, thank you. That has been a bit of a whirlwind. We've ended up with the difficulties of preparation of up-to-date local plans. We've ended up, frankly, in a place where we haven't shown a great deal of enthusiasm for this idea. I think that's a fair summary.
Yes.
And we've identified alternatives for which both the legislation and the procedures are already in place. So maybe what we should do is send a link to this podcast to somebody who might be interested in listening, who's more positive about the idea, and maybe they'll come back and tell us why you're wrong.
We're mistaken, and it will have far-reaching and positive benefits.
Well, try and find that person, Richard. Good luck.
Thank you very much to you both. I've really enjoyed that, and listeners will too, I can guarantee it. So enjoy the rest of your afternoons both, and if I find that person, I'll be back in touch.
Ideal. Thanks, Richard.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Christian.
Thank you.
Cheers.
That was the Planning Podcast from Number 5 Chambers. We hoped that helped. It was a detailed episode. If there's somebody listening in the Labour Party who wants to tell us what their take is in detail on some of those issues, get in touch.